As some of you know, most of you, today's service theme comes from the book A Chosen Faith, An Introduction to Unitarian Universalism, by prominent UU ministers John Burens and the late Forest Church, which examines aspects of UU history, theology, social action, and more. First published in 1989, I believe, as Our Chosen Faith, a revised and expanded edition came out in 1998 with a revised title, A Chosen Faith. As we explore it, I sometimes abridge and at times rearrange some excerpts. I won't say so each time, but the original meaning, if not the original order, is always intact. Also, unlike many co-authored books, different chapters are penned by just one of the two authors. And in the introduction, Reverend Forest Church informs us that the word chosen carries a twofold meaning. First, he writes, for most of us, our faith did not choose us. That is, we weren't born into it. We chose it. And we did so, he continues, because we sought one that fit our own thinking, not one that imposed its thinking on us. Just for fun, let's check out his calculations. If you were born a UU, please raise a hand. Okay, I'm going to count. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. I count 7 out of what? 70? So 10%? So yeah, as calculated, most of us chose this faith somewhere along the line. And Reverend Church then describes the second meaning of chosen this way. Unitarian Universalists are neither a chosen people, nor a people whose choices are made for them by theological authorities, ancient or otherwise. We are a people who choose. Ours is a faith whose authority is grounded in contemporary experience, not ancient revelation. In a Unitarian Universalist church, revelation is an ongoing process. Each of us is a potential harbinger of meaning. To briefly explain our theological origins in a nutshell, several centuries ago, the Unitarians emerged because they rejected the Trinitarian doctrine that Jesus of Nazareth is the only Son of God and the only way to salvation. A while later, the Universalists said two other loud no's, both to the idea of original sin and to eternal damnation. So in its early formal sense, universalism means universal salvation. So no one ends up in hell, except maybe as a spiritual debriefing and cleansing station. I personally feel it's good to debrief while cleansing. In a later chapter, Reverend John Burens speaks about these theologies, which in 1961 came together to form UUism via some Bay Area history. He writes, "The difference between the two sides of our denominational family was once summarized by a minister who knew both Universalism and Unitarian congregations. Thomas Starr King grew up a Massachusetts Universalist, then became the pastor of the first Unitarian church in San Francisco as the Civil War was beginning. He is credited for, quote, saving California for the Union. And the Unitarian Universalist Seminary in Berkeley is named for him, Starr King Seminary, part of the Graduate Theological Union. And Burens shares that Starr King noted the different but highly compatible views of our current UU heritage this way. Quote, the Universalists believe that God is too good to damn them, whereas the Unitarians believe they are too good to be damned. I'll return to this a little later. Like the readings in the back of our gray hymnal and the songs in the teal one, A Chosen Faith's 6 parts are organized around UUism's original 6 sources of what we call our living tradition. Living meaning not historically or theologically fixed, but ever evolving. I say the original 6 because after years of consideration and discussion, in June 2024, an updated version was adopted at the annual UU National Convention known as General Assembly. The new values are equity, generosity, interdependence, justice, pluralism, and transformation centered around love. I may explore these another time, but since A Chosen Faith is written based on the original 6 sources, we'll stick with those. touching on facets of the first two today and the rest on next month. These aren't meant to exclude other influences. As I shared in September, one you said they knew they were in the right place when the minister spoke on some ideas they'd encountered in Mad Magazine. But these six sources have certainly informed UUism's living tradition. And that 2024 Democratic revision process is itself a good example of what the book authors state to close their introduction. Our faith continues to grow and change with changing times. That is why we both chose it. The one-line preamble to the six sources says, "The living tradition we share draws from many sources. One, direct experience of that transcending mystery and wonder affirmed in all cultures, which moves us to a renewal of the spirit and an openness to the forces which create and uphold life." Ralph Waldo Emerson, who began his illustrious public career as a Unitarian minister, and who the early parts of A Chosen Faith draw on frequently, expressed this transcending mystery and wonder in a reading that in our gray hymnal is titled The Oversoul, Here Abridged. "There is a deep power in which we exist and whose beatitude is accessible to us. Every moment when the individual feels invaded by it is memorable. It comes as insight. It comes as serenity and grandeur. Within us is the whole of the soul, the soul of the whole, the wise silence, the universal beauty. When it breaks through our intellect, it is genius. When it breathes through our will, it is virtue. When it flows through our affections, it is love." And in contrast to most UU or most religious traditions, UUs don't hold, in contrast to most religious traditions, UUs hold that no single text or tradition or religious figure has a lock on this transcending mystery and accessible beatitude, nor contains or embodies the eternal, unchanging, unquestionable, capital T, truth, which according to many, if not most, traditional religious views makes UUs heretics, which I, for one, am more than cool with. As is Forrest Church, who in chapter one again underscores A Chosen Faith's title when he writes, "Of course, I am a heretic. The word heresis in Greek means choice. A heretic is one who is able to choose." As Unitarian Universalist, he continues, "We are free to choose our beliefs. Of course, being free, we are responsible for what we make of that freedom. When we employ our freedom responsibly, directly experiencing the transcending mystery and wonder of the creation, our spirits are renewed, and we become open to the forces that create and uphold life," he says. Yet, he continues later, "to affirm life, we must also face death and struggle to make sense of both." Here, too, UUism differs mightily from numerous religious traditions. For as Church says, "offering religious security blankets and heavenly insurance policies, as many faiths base their considerable appeal on a denial of death. They reduce this life to preparation for the next potentially finer life. Most UUs, however, view death not as something unnatural, but as a natural passage, like birth, one of the hinges upon which life turns." That said, Reverend Church proposes that while UUs don't typically need such insurance policies against death, to live our lives fully, we still need to awaken spiritually. And that this happens, he says, when we awaken to the fact that life is not a given, not something to be taken for granted, or transcended after death, but a gift, undeserved and unexpected, holy, awesome, and mysterious. And in keeping with UU's insistence that revelation is not sealed in the past, but always unfolding, he adds that awakening is not a moment, but an ongoing process.
Each time we encounter life's transcending mystery and are moved to a renewal of the spirit and an openness to the forces that create and uphold us, we awaken. And he brings us back around to facing death when he writes, "And should we happen to graduate to another life, a possibility little more remote than that there should be life in the first place, to live well and deeply in this life must surely be the best preparation for advancing to the next." I would agree with that wholeheartedly. Let's recall that our first source begins direct experience of that transcending mystery and wonder. And indeed, the book's second chapter by Reverend John Burens is titled Experience. In it, he says that, "For us, religious experience is direct and personal. It may be joyous, a transformative moment of awakening like being present at a child's birth, or it may be as painful as the birth itself, or as wrenching as grief. Sometimes it takes something very close to our own death, or the death of someone we love, to break through our usual defenses and remind us what a gift life is, what a gift it is to be alive and to be able to love." He then adds that while this heightened awareness of this gift of life needs to have an internal element, external reminders and models also often help. Hence, he says, "This is why Unitarian Universalists choose to gather in religious communities, where other individuals, and yes, a whole tradition, help us to keep heart and conscience and mind receptive. Not only is my religion grounded in my own direct experience," he adds, "but it is also sustained by the experience of others." For sure. Returning from this to Reverend Church's first chapter, he tells us that this awakening has ethical implications. Having accepted life as a gift for ourselves, we are then charged to revere the presence of this same gift in others. As long as we take life for granted, our regard for it is cheapened, and this affects the way we treat others, even those closest to us. And this communal ethical element brings us to Yuyism's second original source that forms the theme for A Chosen Face's second section. Slightly updated for gender-inclusive language, it reads, "Words and deeds of prophetic people, which challenge us to confront powers and structures of evil with justice, compassion, and the transforming power of love." Recall what I said about the Universalists rejecting both original sin and eternal damnation, and the Unitarians rejecting the doctrine that Jesus died to redeem human sinfulness, and how Thomas Starr King summed it up by quipping that the Universalists believe God is too good to damn them, and the Unitarians believe they're too good to be damned. In Part 2's Chapter 3, Deed Not Creeds, Forest Church comments on this. "The problem is that even as a theology based upon evil and sinfulness tends to stint on goodness, one based upon goodness may be equally obtuse when it comes to evil and sin. Too much mercy can squeeze out justice, and too much attention to our better nature can blind us to the awesome capacity for human evil." This reminded me of someone else's observation that in general, conservatives think people are worse than they are, and liberals think people are better than they are. And just a bit later, Church adds the both-and actuality that we are born with a capacity for both good and evil, and society contributes directly to the development of our aptitude for each. I'll insert here that I personally prefer terms like transgression or wrongdoing or moral lapse or blindness to the word sin, with what I consider its heavy association with the severe and punishing side of the Judeo-Christian God image. But Reverend Church is this chapter's author. And while we understand that UUs aren't alone in this, he goes on to submit that UUs can be guilty of what he calls the sin of sophisticated resignation, which allows us to feel strongly about injustices without prompting us to do anything about them. And while affirming that we can be proud of the many UUs who embodied our second source by confronting powers and structures of evil with justice, compassion, and the transforming power of love. He then asks, but what about us? And he says the best answer is to actually ride our moral high horse. That is, to attach actions to our words. As I said 2 weeks ago, our actions will vary according to our temperaments, gifts, and current capacities. Yet whatever forms they assume, in this time of moral crisis, our tradition calls us to express our values through action if we are at all able. For as Reverend Church adds, in short, our hands will not be clean until we get them dirty, until we roll up our sleeves and match our words with deeds. To help us consider what ways we might do this, I'll end by sharing part of a different book titled The Great Turning, From Empire to Earth Community by economics scholar David Corton and Buddhist systems thinker and activist Joanna Macy. In it, they outline a three-part action framework. The first they call actions to slow the damage, which includes direct actions like blockades and boycotts, political and legal interventions, and acts of public witness like marches and rallies. A second avenue they term analysis of structural causes, which works to understand the interlocking systems that indenture us to an insatiable and exploitive economy and its political and corporate overseers, and seeks to create more sustainable and equitable alternatives. Among many others, Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King makes it clear that while charitable services are important, structural change is also vital. As he put it, true compassion is more than flinging a coin to a beggar. It comes to see that an edifice which produces beggars needs restructuring. Which brings to mind words of the late Catholic Archbishop Dom Helder Camara, who worked in a poverty-stricken region in Brazil. When I give food to the poor, they call me a saint. When I ask why the poor have no food, they call me a communist. Corton and Macy's third action area is what they called engendering a shift in consciousness, both through visionary ideas and spiritual awakening, which articulates and instills the underlying values that make wholesale cultural transformation possible. If we give it a little sincere thought, depending on our dispositions and aptitudes, each of us here can likely find a way to plug into one or more of these areas, can take our chosen faith's ideals of universal freedom, dignity, and equity, and, inspired by our second source, identify a way to confront powers and structures of evil with justice, compassion, and the transforming power of love through devoted action. And if you question whether your efforts will matter, recall the words of one prophetic game changer, Mahatma Gandhi. Almost anything you do will seem insignificant, but it is very important that you do it. Or as the Chinese proverb I also shared 2 weeks ago puts it, it is better to light one candle than to curse the darkness. If each of us finds a candle and lights it through action, our world will be that much brighter. I need to stop there. We'll pick up the discussion of a chosen faith in the fireside room after the service and explore the rest of the book on March 22nd. Namaste and blessed be.